First case this morning is United States against Stepin. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Captain Jess Robertson, Colonel Mark Talatochi for the appellant, Private Dustin A. Stepin. The appellant should not be required to show prejudice. Such prejudice must be presumed, as the Air Force Court of Military Review found in United States versus Holt. In Holt, the Air Force Court found prejudice presumed where there has been a failure to comply with the clear statutory disqualification in Article 6C ECMJ, and the appellant had not had the opportunity to raise the error. Now, there are excellent policy reasons for presuming prejudice. One,
counsel, wasn't this issue forfeited? It was not raised before the CCA. Of course, it couldn't be raised previously, but it was not raised before the CCA. Judge Am did that on her own accord, and the majority didn't do anything with the issue.
Correct, Your Honor. However, as you pointed out, the Army Court did review it in the sense that Judge Am filed that dissent.
On her sua sponte, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
It was not raised before as an issue. This case was submitted on its merits, the CCA, was it not?
Correct, Your Honor. But as Finster says, the Court of Criminal Appeals may address prejudicial errors on its own motion and is not limited to the matters, if any, discussed in the accused submission to that court. Article 66C establishes an affirmative obligation on the courts of criminal appeals to review the record and reach their own independent conclusion as to whether the finding...
I'm aware of the powers of the court. The point is that this issue wasn't raised before the court.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, I'll rely on the precedent set in Finster. Again, there are excellent policy reasons for presuming prejudice in this case.
No, the question.
Whoa.
All right, I'm sorry.
Okay. Do you have any case law support for the proposition that this issue isn't forfeited?
Well, Your Honor, I think this falls in line with Finster. In that case, as
I can't hear you, sorry.
Your Honor, I think this case falls in line with Finster.
Finster, okay.
Yes, Your Honor. And in that case, the issue wasn't raised either.
How about as a separate matter, whether it's waiver or forfeiture or some other thing, the fact that the appellant didn't seem too prejudiced by this when he was appearing before the CCA, how does that affect? Is that why you're arguing for a presumption of prejudice rather than some colorable showing of prejudice? Because it's hard to show a colorable showing if you didn't spot it the first time around?
Well, Your Honor, even the danger of a case like this is this involves an addendum, and that's the issue here where the accused didn't have a chance to comment on. Granted, it was not raised at the Army Court of Criminal Appeals.
What do you do about Wheelis? I mean, in Wheelis, that's what this court said should happen and gave the reasons why. The specific reasons why the CCA was the better place to raise these issues than here. So returning to Judge Stuckey's question, why isn't it forfeited?
Well, Your Honor, even if it is forfeited, this court in Finster found plain error and stated...
But if it's forfeited, then we don't get to error.
Well, Your Honor, our position is that it's not forfeited. I'm gonna have to rest on that. Under Finster, this court has reviewed the Army Court's decision. The Army Court saw it under Article 66. Now under Article 67, this court can go ahead and take a look at what the Army Court did. Two judges didn't have anything to say on it, and one did. So therefore, it's proper for this court.
Counsel, if the Army Court had said nothing on this issue and had there been no dissent, would it be within the power of this court to specify the issue and grant relief?
I don't have an answer for you, Your
Honor. Is there any case that stands for the proposition that it's necessary to raise a case at issue before the Court of Criminal Appeals before this court can specify an issue and grant relief?
Again, Your Honor, the appellant's position is that this falls in line with Finster.
Yeah, is there any case that stands for the proposition that an individual forfeits an issue by not raising it before the Court of Criminal Appeals?
I don't have that on my fingers.
Thank you.
Can you answer my question about prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. Even if this court does not presume prejudice is manifest in the appellant's case, because of the significance of the convening authority's action in the military justice.
My specific question was, how is it manifest if you didn't spot it before you went to the CCA? If you're carrying around all this prejudice, why is it Judge Hamm that identified the prejudice rather than you?
Well, I think that's the danger here, and I guess the system works. Congress, when they set up Article 66 and put it on Army Court of Appeals to conduct their own independent review, when there are instances such as this where counsel failed to raise the issue, the Army Court correctly looked at it, and now under Article 67, you can.
No, I understand. That goes to jurisdiction. What I'm asking you is, or maybe we're getting as far as we can get, which is... the prejudice could not have been too manifest if it wasn't observed by the appellant or felt by the appellant until Judge Hamm identified the issue. How do you address that fact?
Well, again, the danger of in this issue, you have an individual who wore numerous hats, signed as trial counsel's chief of military justice, and then signed an addendum. The accused was prejudiced in that manner. The fact that now appellate counsel failed to raise the issue should not preclude this court from reviewing what the Army Court had to say on the issue.
Okay, that's fair. What are your two best, if you don't prevail on the issue of presumption of prejudice, what are your two best prejudice arguments? You can pick three if you want. Trying to get you to zero in.
Yes, Your Honor. Again, even this court does not presume prejudice. Prejudice is manifest in the appellant's case. Because of the significance of the convening authority's action in the military justice system, the recommendation of the staff judge advocate is enormously important.
That sounds like you're going back to the presumption of prejudice, and I think Judge Baker asked you to assume when answering the question that you don't prevail on that.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, appellant made a focus request for clemency, simply requesting that he receive a bad conduct discharge rather than a dishonorable discharge. His request was not unreasonable. In the 1105 matters, appellant stated, one, he was brutally assaulted, punched twice by an NCO. Two, his car was intentionally disabled. Three, the command lost some of the appellant's personal items. Now, appellant defense counsel stressed that the appellant was not asking for confinement credit. Instead, as a testament to growth of this young man, he has forbidden me to ask for a reduction of confinement. His only request is directed towards the nature and character of his discharge. Now, given these circumstances and the severe nature of a dishonorable discharge, appellant has made a colorful showing of possible prejudice. Again, turning defense to this court found prejudice because of the fundamental flaw in the process.
Your theory is that a different person acting as SJA would have made a different recommendation. Is that your theory of prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. What we have is a statutory disqualification. Article 6C says trial counsel cannot later advise a convening authority. What do we have in this case? We have the Chief of Military Justice who signs the trial counsel.
But does that make her a trial counsel? The fact that the Chief of Military Justice signed as trial counsel, does that make her an actual trial counsel? I mean, my understanding is that trial counsel are the people that are detailed to be a trial counsel in a particular case and that actually work on a particular case, meaning that they go to court and that they represent the government in a particular case. And so I guess I would ask you, how was she, in fact, the trial counsel, as opposed to a military justice officer signing for the trial counsel? And does it make a difference? And if not, why?
Well, her acts, and this is what's the appearance of the public that we're dealing with here. We have an individual who signed as trial counsel. If the titles mean nothing.
Well, it didn't even bother the appellant or his defense counsel or his appellate defense counsel, so I'm not sure that the public would be any more concerned than any of those three individuals.
Well, it's my hope that the court, due to the failures of appellant's counsel, I don't think this...
Have you alleged IAC for either the defense counsel or for the appellate defense counsel?
We have not, Your Honor. But in regards to how she acted as a trial counsel, on the RCM 602, the trial counsel detailed the court martial show cause to be served upon the accused. In the discussion to RCM 602, it states the trial counsel should comply with this rule immediately upon receipt of the charges.
Well, what cause to be served? I mean, isn't it in fact that cause to be served means that exactly what it says, that they will make sure that the person is served. And that could be done by the command legal office. It can be done by really just about anybody except for the accuser, I think.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, she was chief of military justice and the staff judge advocate. She just wore too many hats in this case.
But that doesn't answer my separate question, which is, does that make her, in the fact that she signed as a trial counsel, does that in fact make her a trial counsel when there's a statute that talks about detailing and when I think that most people understand a trial counsel to be the person that actually acts as a trial counsel? I mean, if I sign one of my opinions as, you know, Margaret A. Ryan, law clerk, does that make me a law clerk?
Well, no, you're not. No, Your Honor, in regards to you signing as a law clerk. But in this case, as the Army dissent pointed out, the chief of military justice is the chief trial counsel. And as she stated, senior judge advocate should not be blind to this effect. The chief of military justice is behind the scenes pulling the prosecutorial strings. The chief of military justice is directly involved in the prosecutorial capacity in all aspects of the general and special courts martial and take place within these jurisdictions. Now, the chief of military justice reviews the evidence, decides whether further investigation is necessary to prior to referral. So to answer your question, she's the chief trial counsel, and that's where...
So is the answer then that in any case where someone who was at some point the chief of military justice or the military justice officer or whatever you want to make call, whatever you call them, that even though those specific titles are not listed in the statutory list of those that are precluded, that they may never then turn around and act as an SJA in any case?
I'm not sure, never, sir, Your Honor. But what we have here is simultaneously we have trial counsel, chief of military justice, acting staff judge advocate.
Well, you're not suggesting that she, in fact, acted as trial counsel. There's nothing in the record suggesting that, in fact, she took any of the actions that ordinarily a trial counsel does, right? There's no paper saying, there's nothing from the transcript of trial, for instance, suggesting that she appeared and said that she'd been detailed, or that anyone else suggested she'd been detailed?
If your question is did she question the accused, things of that nature, it was just sworn in on the record. The answer to that is no, but what do we...
Well, I'm asking a question that starts even before that. Is there anything in the record that suggests that this individual was detailed to be the trial counsel in this case?
There's nothing in the record, but what is in the record is the charge sheet where she signed twice. She referred the charge as chief of military justice directly below block 15. She signed as the trial counsel, and she served the charges. So that's the danger here. There's the appearance of impropriety. But the same person who was signed as the trial counsel.
You're not saying that the trial, this person was detailed as trial counsel. Your argument is picking up on the language in 1106. That they acted as trial counsel, is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, now please state specifically with reference to page numbers in the record, where is there indication that this person acted as trial counsel? Is it on that data sheet where they sign as trial counsel? Is that, what else, is that one of the examples, and are there others?
Well, no, Your Honor, there's that example, and there's the two I already spoke about where she signed. Is trial counsel signed her name to it? Now, this is a statutory...
Wait, signed her name to what and in what capacity?
As trial counsel, Your Honor. She signed her name as trial counsel on the original charge sheets and the additional charge sheets two times and additional...
As trial counsel, not as chief of military justice.
As trial counsel, directly above that was chief of military justice. Most troubling was when she signed as the acting staff judge advocate in her opinion opined that clemency was not warranted.
Counsel, the government has cited United States against Scalo for the proposition that our review in this case is under the plain error standard. Could you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. You know, that's different from our case. The defense counsel in that case failed to object to the SJR. In this case, we have the defense counsel failed to, or the defense counsel had no opportunity to object in the addendum. Now we've already been down the road in regards to what happened.
Well, is your view that the government has misstated the holding in Scala, that plain error review doesn't apply when the issue has not been raised before the Court of Criminal Appeals?
I'll have to take another look at that and speak to you that on rebuttal, Your Honor.
Thank you. You'll have a further opportunity on rebuttal, although you've got 13 seconds left if you have more to say now.
Speak quickly, yeah.
Thank you. I'll speak to it on rebuttal.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge and judges of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Benjamin Owens Police, and I, along with Major Christopher Burgess, represent the government in this case. Major Wright was the Chief of Justice of the 82nd Airborne Division, who made administrative errors while she was processing the appellant's case. Now, assuming that these administrative errors disqualify Major Wright...
Just to be clear, is that code for acted inconsistent with RCM 1106, or is that some different category of statement?
This court could find that she did act as a trial counsel by signing two preprinted signature blocks and causing the charges.
So the government concedes that she acted as trial counsel.
The government does not concede that. In fact, I think this court
should. So is the government saying she did not violate 1106?
She did not act as trial counsel under Article 6 or RCM 1106, Your Honor.
Even when she signed documents under the clause trial counsel?
That's correct, Your Honor.
She why isn't that acting as trial counsel if you sign something trial counsel?
Well, she made a mistake in signing these documents as trial counsel. There's no dispute that she was, in fact, the Chief of Military Justice. Just by signing these signature blocks that were pre-printed does not somehow change her position.
So what does the record establish as to which trial counsel caused the charges to be served?
The Chief of Military Justice did cause the charges to be served. So if...
Isn't it the responsibility of a trial counsel to cause the charges to be served?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the record that establishes any trial counsel other than the one who's at issue here caused the charges to be served?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And because she mistakenly served the charges, this court could find that she acted as a trial counsel. Now, whether that makes her a trial counsel under Article 6 or whether she's disqualified because she crossed the line from being an advisor to an active participant is ultimately irrelevant to the prejudice test that should be applied by this court. Now, there would are amounts to two lines of authority.
You concede that she acted as trial counsel, but you don't concede that she was a trial counsel.
I do not concede that she acted as trial counsel, Your Honor. This court
You just said that.
No, I said this. It would be reasonable to conclude that she did.
Okay, it would be reasonable to conclude that she acted as trial counsel, but you don't concede it.
That's correct.
That's fair enough. Okay, go ahead.
Now, if she was disqualified as a trial counsel, there are what amounts to two lines of authority on measuring the effect of a disqualified officer advice to a convenient authority. The first is Coulter and its progeny, which dates back to the 1950s, and the second are the newer cases of Johnson Saunders and United States against Stewart's.
Now, do any of those cases involve a situation like where we have in this case, where at most what the person did was sign a few documents as trial counsel?
If I understand your question, Your Honor, are you asking if the extent of the involvement in those cases was as egregious, was more egregious than this case?
Yes.
Is that what you mean? Well, the circumstances of those cases were much more compelling, that's true. They're none of them involved a marginal disqualification. In Johnson-Saunders, the assistant trial counsel argued the government's case during the pre-sentencing. In fact, asking for a harsher sentence than that was adjudged by the military judge. In Edwards, the officer actually interrogated the accused and obtained a confession from that person. In Rice, the officer testified in aggravation for the government and exhibited strong feelings of personal bias. In this case, Major Wright did was sign two pre-printed signature blocks and cause the charges to be served on the appellant. In light of that, There is no firm basis to infer that she was, in fact, biased when executing her duties as an acting staff judge and advocate.
Is that the test?
Well, the actual prejudice...
Do you have to have a showing of actual prejudice?
I don't think the appellant should be required to make a showing of actual prejudice.
Well, then, no. Then what's the point of the argument?
I think what Edwards and what Edwards makes clear is that there must be at least a firm basis to infer that somebody was not neutral, that somebody acted in a biased manner.
No. Doesn't the statute set up a plain meaning test? He who acts as trial counsel may not act as. I mean, there any bias or prejudice in there. There may be, the motivation of Congress may have been to avoid bias or prejudice. The motivation of Congress may have been to avoid the appearance of bias or prejudice. But there's nothing in the statute that says anything about bias or prejudice. It just says that he who does this may not do that.
But you are making a prejudice argument.
I'm making a prejudice argument.
You're making a prejudice argument.
Yeah. As to error, that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. But this Court has stated in the past that that just because somebody was disqualified, that doesn't make their recommendation void.
I mean, aren't we still bound by Article 59?
That's correct, Your Honor. And this Court is bound by Article 59 alpha. In that regard, United States against Edwards and United States against Rice look to the conduct of the disqualified officer to determine whether he or she was biased against the appellant when making their recommendation. Now, also, many of these cases cite United States against Fisher, which was a plain error case prior to United States.
Is it fair to say then that part of your argument is that the more active the person is in acting as trial counsel, the more likely there will be colorable prejudice?
That's correct, Your Honor. Absolutely. In the actions that somebody takes...
And the inverse is the less they do, the less likely, depending on what it is, of course. But
absolutely. The actions they take is probative on whether they were, in fact, biased against the appellant.
Does that give the defense right to discover the inner workings of the trial team after trial? In other words, if we have a case like this, and after trial, the defense discovers that the person who acted as trial counsel in the case now is providing the SJA's recommendation to the convening authority, can the defense move for a post-trial Article 39A session in which they can probe into the operation of the prosecution so that they can determine whether the person was or was not acting actively in the case? Is that what the government wants us to have here?
It sounds like a reasonable course of action, although I'm not prepared to answer the question about when somebody could be justified in being granted a post-trial Article 39A session. But if the defense or if an appellant were to come forward with evidence that somebody was disqualified and acted later in advising the convening authority...
Why wouldn't the government just say, the last thing we want to have is somebody probing how we conduct our prosecutions in these cases. We'll have somebody else prepare the post-trial recommendation. Is a post-trial recommendation so important that you'd rather have a post-trial hearing into all the inner workings of the prosecution, their strategy and tactics, and who may or may not have been advising them from the Chief of Judge of Justice's operation?
I think the tenor of your question makes a good point, is that the government doesn't have some kind of course of conduct where this is our normal practice. The government doesn't generally seek to have somebody that's disqualified or acts for the prosecution to advise the convening authority. There's no question that in this case, Major Wright made a mistake when she was processing appellant's case and didn't realize that later that would lead people to scrutinize her recommendation to the convening authority. However, that does not show that appellant was unfairly prejudiced by her recommendation to the convening authority. Where a legal officer SJA is disqualified by Article 6, this court should require appellant to make a colorable showing of possible prejudice. Now, appellant has failed to meet that burden in this case. This court should affirm the Army Court.
One question. If we don't presume prejudice, doesn't it follow that then, especially in a case like this where all he was asking for was an upgrade of his punitive discharge, doesn't that require us to engage in rather abstract speculation as to what might have been the result had the the barred person not done what she ought not to have done? And how are we going to go about that?
There is, I mean, it is a truism that we cannot know what might have been different if
we cannot know the unknown, the known unknowns.
Right, but I mean, in Wheelis, this court addressed that situation and said that to address the inherently discretionary act of the convening authority, this court would instead lower the threshold of the colorable of the showing of prejudice on appeal, and that would be to require appellants to make a colorable showing of possible prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Your Honor, in regards to Scalo, I'll say this. I rely on U.S. v. Taylor. And whether a statute advocate or convening authority is disqualified from participating in the post-trial review is a question of law that we review de novo. As we conduct our analysis, the defense has the initial burden of making a prima facie case. Now, as Kelly said, we have to show some possible color of prejudice. And appellant's done that in the sense that what I heard questions is a fair rebuttal, that we just don't know what will happen when we have a what appears to be a biased individual, at a minimum a statutory disqualified individual, from advising the convening authority.
Can you just help me? What is it about this case that you can point to that suggests that a different person would have given a different staff judge advocate recommendation? And or that the convening authority would have taken any different action than he did. I see the argument that this is a financial crime, but it's also a crime involving thefts from basically comrades in arms who are about to deploy. So it's not like, you know, he just bounced a check or stole $15 from the 7-Eleven.
Yes, Your Honor. What I can point to is the fact that the chief trial counsel, the individual who's charged with putting soldiers out of the armor for the very acts, or behind bars for the very acts that you just articulated, ma'am, that individual then strode into the convening authority's office and handed the addendum and said, in her opinion, no clemency was warranted. And that's the tough thing about these cases. We have to recognize that Congress has prohibited this conduct, and there is an appearance of impropriety when an unqualified officer advises the convening authority.
What's the remedy? If we agree with you, what's the remedy?
New SCR in action, Your Honor.
I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. New SCR in action, Your Honor. Any questions?
So your prejudice argument essentially boils down to a different person writing the SCR might have recommended a DCD rather than a DD, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Could have. We have a statutory disqualification. They have the appearance of impropriety.
Is there anything in the SJAR, or whatever you call it, in the recommendation that indicates bias on your view?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the document itself that reflects bias, or is your concern that just say someone who had not acted in the role that this person acted might have recommended something differently?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. It's her signature. She had acted as trial counsel, chief of military justice.
Right, no, I understand that, but you're not arguing that the words themselves convey bias or suggest anything.
It's no, not the words themselves.
No, I'm just making sure I understand your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. The court will be in recess until 5 minutes after 10 o'clock.
Court will be in recess until 10:05.